Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian, where every 7 days we explore the latest ins and outs of the high-tech world. My name is Bobby Johnston and this week I'm once again in the pilot seat as we start the countdown and launch ourselves into another episode. In this show, we'll hear the extraordinary reasons why NASA plans to crash a spacecraft into the moon and discover how the space agency's latest unusual mission could help change the course of space exploration. Then, we'll switch from rockets to pockets as Charles test drives the MiFi, a new gadget that lets you carry around a wireless hotspot wherever you go. Now, if that hasn't got you tingling with expectation, then we'll also be getting a flash of news from the heavens and mooning over your comments and feedback on last week's show. So, get yourself ready and let's boldly go where no one has gone before. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Now, I don't know what you're doing on Friday, perhaps going to work, taking a long weekend, or even just sitting back and listening to your favourite podcast. We know which one that is, of course. But whatever you're doing, spare a thought for the drama that's going to be playing out hundreds of thousands of miles above the Earth's surface. That's where a NASA mission called LCROSS, the Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite, will be culminating as two high-speed spacecraft smash into the moon near its south pole. A $79 million kamikaze strike on the lunar surface may seem crazy, but the idea is to use the crash to throw up a huge cloud of debris above the moon's surface for observation. Why would you do that? Well, it turns out there are plenty of reasons. And I caught up with Dr. Kim Eneko, one of the scientists at the NASA Ames Research Center who's been working on LCROSS, and asked her to explain what would be happening in a little more detail.
We are taking a blunt body, which is the upper stage of the launch vehicle, which would otherwise be known as space junk and come back to Earth. We're actually using it in a unique way, and that is to hit the moon and excavate the basin of a crater at the lunar south pole. And we also have this shepherding spacecraft that follows the Centaur rocket 4 minutes behind, taking data of the lunar soil that's being brought up into the sunlight. And what we want to do is do remote sampling and look at camera images and spectra to understand what's in that soil. And the soil has evidence of strong hydrogen signatures, and one of the leading theories is that it is due to water ice that's either absorbed or in part of the grains. And the experiment will tell us whether there's water in that particular area that we excavate.
If there's anywhere on the moon that's going to tell you this, you're hoping that this particular crater is going to be the one. What do you hope to see? What would be your conclusive evidence?
We wanted to make sure we hit a crater that was kind of fluffy. It didn't quite have a lot of rocks and boulders so that we can excavate a lot of material up. We also needed to make sure that it was visible from our spacecraft and also from Earth, because we have a lot of eyes looking at this experiment. So the crater rim, it was of importance. And then, of course, we wanted to make sure that that crater had a lot of hydrogen. And right now, the favored target is Kebeus. There are three craters in the Kebeus region that have really strong hydrogen signatures, and we are using the latest LRO data that's an orbiter around the moon right now to fine-tune between the two areas in the Kebeus region that really look like very promising. When the impact occurs, there is a brief flash that lasts about 100 milliseconds, followed by actually the material that has been excavated by the event will travel, we hope, as high as 10 kilometers above the surface. At least that's where the most of the visible mass will be. And that ejecta curtain, that plume, is going to last only about 1 to 1.5 minutes.
What does it mean if we found it? What does it tell us about the way the universe was made? And does it also play into maybe a manned mission to the moon as well?
Finding resources on the moon, be it water, hydrogen, oxygen, or helium, any type of resource for building, for crops, for fuel. If it's there and you can live off the land, I mean, that's what we did when we explored other continents on our own planet. And if we're going out to explore other places in the solar system, you can live off the land that's more beneficial than trying to take it in with you.
I'm really fascinated by the cost aspect of LCROSS, because as far as I understand it, this was a mission that was kind of pulled together exceedingly quickly, that used a lot of off-the-shelf components. You know, it was kind of the opposite of what a lot of us think about NASA, you know, these incredibly long, expensive projects that take years and years to come to fruition. You guys had less than 3 years from start to finish, didn't you? So can you How did it come about?
We went from authority to proceed to space scale delivery in 28 months with a high-fidelity spacecraft, with known risks, because we knew what we were accepting by an accelerated schedule. It was very a new paradigm, but it worked efficiently well if you plan appropriately and you see where you can be innovative. You can see what you can reuse. I am used to the old NASA paradigm of taking lots of years to build an instrument, but that's usually when you're going after something that you've never done before and you don't know what you're going to expect, but it's new science, new areas you haven't probed, so you have to build a unique instrument. Here we had a very focused goal. We're looking for water. We had an idea of what we might be expecting, so we sized the experiment appropriately, and we found that there were instruments available that are used in industry. They're used in auto car racing. They're used in the military. They're used in environmental industry, in field work. They go through a ruggedized lifestyle anyway, and they're available in catalogs, and they have the sensitivity to measure water. So we turned it upside down. We're making a measurement using existing instruments, but using them in an innovative way.
Have you learned lots of things that you can feed back into the system that you can use for future missions?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, basically, with the LCROSS story, we can show that it can be done. Being a secondary payload forced you to keep the schedule because you always had that threat that you wouldn't fly. And that's what made it real. And I can't see why it can't be done again. I am hopeful that there'll be other opportunities.
If that separation doesn't work properly, then it becomes a lot trickier for you. Is that the crucial point that needs to operate?
We have these release clamps that need to release, and we have contingencies in place to try them again if they don't release. If they don't release, we still go in. It's just that we'll be relying on the Earth assets, all the eyes looking at LCROSS and LRO and HST and the other Earth orbiters that are looking at it to provide that data. Now, the LCROSS impact is only visible to areas western of the Mississippi River, and it's centered over Hawaii and the western United States, so people in Britain will not be able to see the impact. You'll be able to see it, images from the spacecraft, on a NASA TV, which will show a live broadcast. I do know of some telescopes trying to see separation, because you can actually image separation from possibly, it'd be very hard, you're several degrees from the moon. But some telescopes in Canary Islands and in maybe parts of Europe might be observing the separation at 150 UTC, because the moon's up in that part of the world at that time.
Kimberly Eneko of NASA, and you can find out more about the mission at nasa.gov/LCROSS, including, let's hope, live footage of the Centaur booster crashing into the moon at around 12:30 UK time this Friday afternoon. That's October the 9th. We'll also have more detail in this Thursday's Technology Guardian, and I'm sure our chums over at the Guardian Science Weekly podcast will also be keeping their eyes on what's happening. Now, let's bring things back down to earth with a look at this week's top news headlines.
Users of Hotmail have been told to change their passwords after more than 10,000 people's login details were stolen and published online. Microsoft says the leak was the result of an anonymous phishing attack, but experts have suggested all users act just in case they were among the victims. Better news for Microsoft on Tuesday as it launched the latest version of its phone system, Windows Mobile. The company's ambitions in the handset market have taken a beating from competitors such as the iPhone, BlackBerry and Google's Android recently, but boss Steve Ballmer is hoping that its new system can get things back on track. Google has finally opened up access to Wave, a real-time communication tool it says will rethink how people work. Around 100,000 people have been given early access to the product, which has been described as a cross between instant messaging, email and document sharing, but initial reviews have been mixed. And finally, football fans will be flooding online this weekend after a series of financial calamities led to England's World Cup qualifier against Ukraine being shown only on the internet. Following the collapse of pay TV company Setanta, the rights for the game were taken up by digital sports company Perform, which is streaming the game live on Saturday afternoon at ukrainevengland.com for anyone willing to shell out £4.99.
Thanks for that, and if you want to keep up with those stories and everything else that's going on, then go to guardian.co.uk/technology for all the latest news from around the high-tech world. Now, for anyone who, like me, spends a lot of time on the move, the rise of mobile internet access has been a revelation. And although 3G coverage might not be as prevalent or as fast as we'd like, falling prices have tempted many people to buy a 3G dongle. But what's the next step? Well, how about the MiFi? It's a gadget that's being sold by Three in Britain and promises to give you access to the internet on the go. But instead of just connecting your computer to the web, it creates a personal wireless hotspot, allowing you to connect up to 5 Wi-Fi-enabled devices to the mobile internet. That means you could theoretically hook up your laptop, smartphone, music player, handheld game console, and even some digital cameras, all on the go. Well, it kind of sounds nice, doesn't it? But how does it really work, and, crucially, how useful is it in real life? Our own Charles Arthur had the MiFi for a weekend, and he decided to put it to the test.
Mobile broadband dongles have become cheaper and ubiquitous over the past few years, and very popular with commuters. It's potentially crucial to the future of broadband in the country after the Digital Britain report suggested mobile broadband could solve the problem of getting rural locations connected. So the 3 MiFi router is an interesting development. It's a palm-sized device which holds a mobile SIM card and connects to the mobile data network. But it also creates a mobile Wi-Fi spot for you, so your mobile broadband isn't restricted to your laptop any longer. You don't have to plug anything into your computer, and you can connect lots of devices. David Carrigan, 3's head of internet services, explained a bit more about it.
You can create a Wi-Fi hotspot wherever you are, whenever you need it, and get the benefit of being online with any device that has Wi-Fi. So things like iPod Touch, PlayStation Portable, Nintendo DS, laptops, you can connect them all without having to hunt around for a Wi-Fi hotspot.
I'm at home and I'm trying out speedtest.net, which is a website that you can go to find out what sort of speeds you're getting for your downloads, your uploads, and also the latency. So I'm going to try it now with my wireless connection that I usually have with my standard landline broadband. We'll see how that goes. It's showing it going at about 5.2 megabits per second. Now it's trying the upload speed. It's not going so well. It's pretty slow doing the uploads compared to the downloads. But there we go. We got the download speed of 5.3 megabits per second and an upload of 0.37 megabits. So that's my landline. I'm switching over to the 3 modem. It's a neat little device. I've got it hanging up by a window because I'm trying to recharge it at the same time as getting it somewhere where it might get a mobile signal. The problem is that I'm getting a red signal for the mobile phone signal, which suggests that it's not actually able to connect to the net. It's resolving to Google Co.UK, so it might be able to find it. Okay, we've got Google, so that's a start. And now I'll go and have a look. It's speedtest.net, and we'll see what sort of upload and download we get there. It is quite a lot slower. Quite a lot slower. Did I mention it's quite a lot slower? Okay, preparing the download. The ping was 169 milliseconds compared to the previous one, which was only a few. It reckons it's getting about 1 megabit per second, 1.5, 1.8... Is it going to reach 2? Oh, no, it's slipping back. Oh, it's quite exciting, this. 2.15 megabits per second. That's not bad. Some people would pay good money to get 2.2 megabits. The upload is 1.07 megabits per second. It's actually better on the upload than my landline is. I guess there's less contention. So there you go. It's not doing badly from a home service. It reckons for a video clip of 35 megabytes, that would take about 2 minutes. As we said, that there's a lot of people out there who would benefit from getting 2.1 megabits per second. They'd certainly be happy with 1 megabit per second for the upload. The ping, which is the latency, which is how long it takes for the signal to come back, though, 169 milliseconds. That's pretty slow. So it does fairly well at home. And for some people, if you can get a good enough signal, it might be better than what you can get with traditional wired broadband. But the main customer for this must be people who travel a lot, or the commuter, as it opens up 3's generous data plans to all your devices for applications such as Spotify, gaming, and much more. So I slipped the MiFi into my pocket and set off to work to see how it would get on. I'm at my local train station and sitting in the waiting room waiting for a train. I'm logged on to speedtest.net again to see how things are. loads pretty quickly here. The upload speed is heading for about 2.2 megabits per second. Now it's trying the upload speed. 0.2 megabits per second, that's quite a slow upload speed comparatively. But the fact is you can get online and you can surf. You could probably get iPlayer. And I'm just clicking fairly randomly on one which is the life and death of a mobile phone. Let's see how it goes. Click to play, let's play. 20 seconds later, that's the BBC 4 IDN. And after another 15 seconds...
Here I am, one of 3 billion phones in the world. You and your fellow Brits clocked up 99 billion minutes of chat last year.
That's not bad, is it? It's coming over. The picture is actually quite good, believe me. That's very clear. So the next thing to try will be seeing if it works on the train when we're actually moving. Okay, well, I'm on the train now, and it goes up and down, it has to be said. The connection doesn't always stick. So let's try going back to that life and death of a mobile phone that I had on iPlayer and see how that goes. I'm around Bishop Stortford, and the connection doesn't always do too well. It's dropped in and out. Mobile broadband not spots are rather more noticeable than the fixed broadband ones, I think. Yeah, it's not getting anywhere. It's trying to look up the BBC, but not finding it. The little gizmo shows red where the phone connection should be, which means it's getting a bad signal. The actual gizmo itself gets quite warm in your hand if you take it out of your pocket, which is where I've been having it. It's quite a little hand warmer in its own right. Back to green on the phone signal. I'll see if I can reconnect the mobile signal. And to do that, you have to press a little button on the side. It's blinking, but it's not doing much better. We've gone a few miles down the track, and it's just given up entirely. Just isn't enough mobile broadband for us here. Oh, well.
This train is for London Liverpool Street.
In the end, I was pleased with the MiFi. It's very good at just getting connected. It's very simple. You press a button, the lights tell you what's happening or not happening. But it wasn't that good at telling you how fast your connection is. Other points that I thought were worth noting was that it's very small. It does get a bit hot, so you wouldn't want to have it in a trouser pocket. And the signs were sometimes difficult to interpret. I couldn't tell whether we were getting a good mobile broadband signal or a bad one. It seemed to go between being green and being blue. But otherwise, very nice. If I had to give it marks, I'd give it 8 out of 10. It's an interesting idea and a very good implementation.
That was Charles Arthur having some fun with the MiFi from 3. It's on pay monthly and pay as you go, and you can find out more about it and the price plans at 3.co.uk/MiFi. Well, there's not that much left for me to say in this episode, but it's probably a good moment to alert you to this week's Technology Guardian, which hits the streets on Thursday. As we said earlier, it's going to feature some more about NASA's LCROSS mission, as well as a look at how to watch TV on your computer and vice versa, as well as featuring an interview with the man behind Google News, and plenty more as always. Just £1 from your newsagent or online at guardian.co.uk/technology. And after that plug, there's still a little time for me to take a walk through your comments and messages. Thanks to everyone on Twitter who retweeted the show. We always love it when you help us spread the word. But the main talking point from last week was our interview with EA Sports producer David Rutter, one of the team behind FIFA 10. On the question of why we fork out for new versions of sports games every single year, Super Smashin said, "I do think the annual releases are a little too much. Full games every 2 years with vastly improved gameplay could be broken up in each alternative year with a team/player update. Good idea, whether they'll adopt it. I think David didn't seem that convinced last week. Not sure he will in the future. Meanwhile, I am JGW said, FIFA 10? PES? Psst. What about Sensible World of Soccer? He then added, "Not that I ever play it, of course. I just want for once to be like the guys who shout Linux for the win during a PC versus Mac flame war." Well, job done. The Narrow Way, meanwhile, wondered whether, while the graphics on FIFA 10 look superb, will this run on a cheap laptop with an Atom processor and 160 gig of RAM? Or do you need a laptop with a dual-core processor to run it? Well, I think the 160 gig of RAM was a typo there, but actually it doesn't matter whether it was or not. No, you won't, is the answer. Although the EA Sports team haven't changed the graphics engine for the PC version of FIFA 10, that's because they say people's machines haven't really progressed very much since they released FIFA 9, it still requires a dual-core processor and 2 gigs of RAM. That's going to be beyond the casual laptop gamer, but really, FIFA's core business, to be honest, is in the console market. So, yes, that's a bit disappointing, but unfortunately, it's the way life is. Meanwhile, over on our Facebook group, Juan Carlos Mendez from Colombia said, as well as saying the show was great, thank you very much, that we should also talk about Google Wave. A very good point. Aside from that mention in the news earlier on, I'm sure we'll be digging into what Wave has to offer very soon indeed. However, I think it's going to take a little while to let the hype wash away and actually let developers get to grips with what it's for. But nonetheless, thanks very much, Juan Carlos. As always, we appreciate your feedback. So if you've got anything to say about this week's show, then there are plenty of ways to get in contact. You can leave a comment on the blog, send us a message via Twitter, try following @GuardianTW specifically for the show, or @GuardianTech for all of the rest of our prodigious technology output. Or you can go, like Juan Carlos did, to our Facebook group and sign up there. All the details on how to get in touch with us are on our show page, which lives at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. That's it from me for this week. All that's left is for me to thank our interviewee, Dr. Kimberly Enico, and our intrepid gadget tester, Charles Arthur. The producer this week was Scott Corley. My name is Bobby Johnson, and thank you for listening.